The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Where did the monster concept come from?
I think it probably originated when I was a kid. I was really into books about Greek mythology. I started out with the Perseus myth and Medusa. And I never wrote about that stuff, except when I was in grade school. And then after I left the University of Montana's program, I had about 3 years where I didn't write anything. And when I returned to writing, I felt so rusty and so almost unfamiliar with it that the best way for me to get back into it was to just enjoy it again. And kind of going back to those childhood roots was really fun for me. And I got to bring those characters back to life in this weird, quirky way. And so the first story in the collection was really the first monster story I wrote, and that's the Cyclops story that I'll read a little bit of today.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Sharma Shields about her collection of stories titled Favorite Monster. I'm not surprised to hear that this started in childhood, because your stories have that really imaginative and vivid quality of stories that kids would tell. Were there people in your life who encouraged your storytelling?
Yes. My mom was always very encouraging. She said that from the second I could start drawing, I was trying to create books and trying to create stories. I had teachers in grade school that noticed how much I loved writing. In fact, recently I gave a reading at Auntie's bookstore here in town, and my sixth grade teacher was there. Mrs. Bean was her name then. She has a different name now. But she was laughing because when I was in sixth grade, whenever I would get in trouble, and usually I would get in trouble because I would write some sarcastic story about my classmates, and then it would accidentally be circulated, and then I'd be in trouble for writing this scandalous story about my classmates. And for example, she was a character, but her name, instead of Mrs. Bean, was Mrs. Beanie Weenie in this story. And she told me that to punish me, she would tell me, I'm not going to let you go to the Young Writers Conference. So that was my big punishment. And I did. I always loved stories. I always wrote stories for my friends, for my brother, for my family. And my mom especially was really always very supportive of that. Both my parents were.
Well, this collection of stories presents many types of monsters, human and mythological, and there are lots of scenarios. Some seem like magical realism, but there are also stories about normal people who exhibit monstrous behavior. I mean, the story, they don't turn into monsters in the story, but I'm thinking in particular about the story you titled Pulchritudinous, yes, which is not a word you come across very often. So tell us about that word and your characters.
Well, pulchritudinous, I think the quote about that word in the story is it's an ugly word for beautiful. And there's a fake magazine, a beauty magazine, in the story called Pulchritudinous. And the narrator talks about the magazine because she works at a grocery store, and they get free magazines with the covers torn off. It's one of the perks of this kind of terrible job she has, making minimum wage. But she's in high school. She works with several people that are quite different from her, older people. And there's one coworker in particular that she ends up defending from a very cruel customer. And this is a coworker that has clearly been sort of verbally and maybe more than verbally abused her whole life. But later on in the story, the narrator ends up doing something very cruel to this woman. And that is true. That's a very monstrous behavior that comes out. And it is definitely meant to be disturbing.
Yeah, it was disturbing.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. It was a very intentional move by me to have this girl do something really disturbing because I wanted her to really battle with how she considers herself, how she sees herself after doing something like that, and how she can move forward and do the right thing after that. And that's kind of where the story ends, is her struggling.
So let's go back to the Cyclops and hear some of that story.
Sure. This is called The McGoogle Account. We were all surprised when Brian hired the Cyclops. His references only spoke Greek. His sole job experience was shepherding. It was uncertain if he could commit to 2 years. No matter. Brian saw something formidable in him. He had followed a similar hunch when he hired me. Despite my lack of PR experience and despite my nervous stutter during the interview, I had become one of our company's top performers. I'm going to skip down a little bit. So she's talking to one of her clients on the phone, and I'm just going to skip to the portion where she meets the Cyclops for the first time. Brian and the Cyclops approached my desk, smiling broadly. I stood and extended my hand. Like prairie dogs risen from their earthen holes, the heads of my colleagues bobbed above the cubicle walls, their expressions less curious than bored. With a sense of wonderment, I allowed the Cyclops' hand to swallow up my own. "It's a delight to meet you, Miss Horn," he said. "Brian was raving about your work here." So soft his voice, as though it could lull you to sleep. He was very well spoken for a Cyclops. I told this to my colleague Kent later that day. Kent grunted and rolled his eyes. "More proof of Brian's incompetence," Kent said. His gelled hair sat stiffly on his head like the shining blade of a guillotine. "He's obviously a monster. Did you smell him?" "Like cooked garbage," an intern agreed. "I thought he was nice," I said. We were standing around the fax machine, 5 or 6 of us, waiting for our faxes to crawl out of the machine's unsmiling mouth. "Nice is the adjective people use when they don't have something better to say," Kent intoned. Then he sang loudly, "Carol's found a new boyfriend." My coworkers laughed. "Yeah, right," I said with feigned playfulness. "I mean, come on, he's totally gross. Really, he's disgusting." But truthfully, I didn't find the Cyclops gross or disgusting. Aside from the large club he always carried, for wolves or worse, he told me, and despite the smell of livestock that trailed him everywhere, he was far more refined and thoughtful than the other men in the office. His pants, while faintly stained, were always neatly pressed. He could quote entire poems of Yeats and Sappho. Even more impressive was that he always asked everyone, no matter how busy he was, how his or her day was going. Clients perceived his incongruity as a sign of superiority and began requesting his services. To my delight, we were teamed up on a new project together, and after a few engaging weeks, I complimented him on his impressive vocabulary and grammar. "I read a lot of books in the field," the Cyclops explained. He meant field literally, as in the field where he shepherded goats. I pictured him lolling on a vast green hillside, his feet and chest bare, holding a hardcover book above his face at just the right angle to block the hot Mediterranean sun. "Any favorites?" I asked. I had been a literature major in college and in my rare haughty moments fancied myself a scholar. "Of our contemporaries, I enjoy Cormac McCarthy. I like tales of war and death. But the authors I forever return to are long perished. Tolstoy, Homer, Proust. Have you ever read Proust?" Proust was one of those authors I wanted desperately to read but knew I never would. I had been assigned a few chapters in college that I completely blew off for a week of reality television. For much of my life, I wore my unfamiliarity with Proust like a red cloak of literary shame. The fact that even the spelunking Cyclops had read Proust was a bit humiliating. "Proust," I said. "Yes, of course." The Cyclops smiled at me, displaying the crooked gray kernels of his teeth. "I like you, Carol," he said. "You don't seem like the type that would work in a PR firm." "Neither do you," I told him. This time, I wasn't lying. Skipping down just a little bit further to where they actually start working together on a project at the PR firm. A few days later, the McGoogle account was created. The Cyclops and I were assigned to the same team. I was typically the go-to girl in such situations, but the McGoogle Corporation had fallen into near disrepair. The youngest McCougal's son was in court, defending himself from three sexual harassment accusations. The McCougal trophy wife was an admitted cokehead and alcoholic. While on a wine tasting tour of the Yakima Valley, she drove her car through the brick wall of a winery's tasting room. Mr. McCougal himself was rumored to be the most avid patron of a high-class escort ring. It was a big company and a bigger mess. "You mortals," the Cyclops muttered with a woeful shake of his head. "We were eating pizza slices in the office near midnight. We were trying to find a positive light in all of this. No matter what you have, it's never enough." Kent found this remark offensive. "What about you? You were a shepherd. Wasn't that a blissful enough existence? It's not like you were recruited here, you know." Some of my colleagues snorted. Earlier, the Cyclops had shoveled down an entire goat cheese pizza while the hungry interns glowered at him. They had shuffled in their chairs and muttered angrily to one another, but avoided any direct invective. The Cyclops' large spiked club lay casually on the table near his BlackBerry, and the interns eyed it uneasily. "For your information," the Cyclops said tersely, "my goats died." He had pizza sauce on his earlobe. He started to say something else, but then stopped. "What?" the boldest of the interns responded. "Did you eat them?" The Cyclops' face reddened. "We're getting off task," I said loudly. "Let's please turn our attention back to the press release. I personally enjoy the idea of a McCougal bazaar. Anyone else?" As the team began their vociferous opining, I caught the Cyclops' eye and touched my earlobe carefully. His eye widened. He reached up with his giant hairy hand to remove the sauce from his ear. It smeared onto his fingers like blood. He gazed back at me gratefully. I considered winking but abstained, as I assumed such an innocuous gesture could be offensive to any creature possessing only one eye. An hour later, the Cyclops escorted me to my car. He held his club menacingly and commented that a young, beautiful woman should not be walking alone so late at night. I blushed. 35 is not so young, I told him. You're a mere girl in Cyclops years. We reached my car. I jangled my keys. Well, I said, thank you. No, thank you. His eye was staring down at me mushily. I was nervous that he would try to kiss me right then and there in the parking lot, where one of my colleagues might find us. Instead, he leaned against his club and looked up at the stars. "Desire makes everything bloom," he said wistfully. What? The Cyclops looked down at me again. Don't you remember? Proust. For lack of an answer, I dropped my keys. I stooped to pick them up, and so did the Cyclops, and his forehead hit the back of my head so hard that I dropped to the ground. Yellow blotches swarmed like bees in my vision. Oh dear, he says, that smarts, I'll bet. He helped me to my feet. In the lamplight, his face was wretched and scarred and now twisted with worry. I'm all right, I said, brushing his hands away. My ears rang and my head ached. I'm all right. I got in my car. He rapped on the window with his acorn-sized knuckles. I rolled the window down and looked up at him, smiling nervously. I'm sorry about your head, he said softly. I know. It's okay. It was an accident. I really meant it when I said thank you. I smoothed my skirt under my thighs and then poked the key into the ignition. You haven't read Proust, he said suddenly, folding his wide, hairy fingers over the door. It was not a question. I sat back in surprise, my hands dropping into my lap. I knew it. His voice was gentle, forgiving. Something like a large flower opened sadly within me. I didn't mean to lie, I said, even though that was a lie, too. I wanted to recline in the front seat and go to sleep. The Cyclops cleared his throat. Lies are essential to humanity. They are perhaps as important as the pursuit of pleasure, and moreover are dictated by that pursuit. He crouched down next to me as he spoke, his big head hanging like a rough pale planet in the window. Proust again, I said. He nodded and reached for me. He pressed his big lips onto mine. I was surprised at how gentle and sweet he was, quite the opposite of what you would expect from one so big and rough. I opened my eyes to find his wide, high eye staring absently over my hairline. He released me and invited me to his cave.
That was Spokane author Sharma Shields reading from one of the stories in her collection titled Favorite Monster. You'll find information about her and the book at therightquestion.blogspot.com. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. We'll be back to continue our conversation right after a short break. Don't go away. So what's the backstory to Tylenol Cheerleader?
Tylenol Cheerleader, I wrote only the very first chapter to that piece originally, which is just the press release. And I'm not quite sure why I wrote that, except that I wanted to discuss the ubiquity of advertisements, how they're just laid out for us everywhere. It's just a part of our walking existence to see ads on TV, on billboards, labels on t-shirts, on our phones, everywhere. And I thought it would be such a creepy, funny story idea to have, you know, an actual drug that causes the ad to appear in your mind's eye, which is what the Tylenol Cheerleader is. She's this literal cheerleader for Tylenol that comes up with her wild pom-poms. And after I wrote her, I sent it to McSweeney's, and they responded and said that they really liked it, but that they thought it should be a little longer. So I added the next two parts to it.
It was funny, but also disturbing. I mean, there's a disturbing element to most of your stories, but not, you know, not in an off-putting way, but it just gives you a lot to think about. Whenever you take Tylenol, this cheerleader is like in the haze of the periphery of your mind.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in that second chapter, she is a woman who has the same drug coursing through her, but it's Delia, the Clorox housewife, instead of Tylenol cheerleader. And then the third chapter is told from Alice, the Tylenol cheerleader's perspective, as she's talking to Charles Pinkley, who's mentioned in the press release. He's given a year's free supply of Tylenol for his input on the product. And then in that third chapter, she speaks to him, and she has a pretty firm control over his life now. And is basically guiding him through the streets to get to the drugstore to get more Tylenol.
Another one of your stories that involves mythology is the one where Medusa is a little girl and turns the main character's brother into stone accidentally.
Yes.
Do you have a brother?
I do. I know. I wonder what my brother and I are very close. In fact, he was helping out. He and his wife, who's also wonderful, were helping out with my kids today while I've been running around and doing the different events. And we're very close. But that story is very much about sibling rivalry. And I think with all siblings, there's a push and a pull going on. And no matter how close you are with that sibling, there are going to be these moments of I think hatred and rage that come out, just as well as there's the unconditional love there. I think it's one of the beauties of siblinghood that those can both exist, and that you can have that depth in the relationship. It's unlike any other relationship, really. But the story definitely deals with the narrator's kind of unspoken guilt about this she's grateful that her brother was never really a presence in her life, except for those young years before he was turned to stone.
What I thought was one of the most powerful metaphors in the collection comes in the story titled The Chirp of the Cricket. It's a story in which a husband begins to shrink over a period of time, and he shrinks down into a tiny cricket. And I was just wondering if you would read the first few paragraphs of that story.
Oh, sure. This was the newest story in the collection and probably my favorite one in here. The Chirp of the Cricket. Last year, my husband began to shrink. Roy noticed it first. For a week or so, he merely observed the change, expecting the loss to reverse itself. But each day upon awakening, he would find himself further reduced. Despite the swiftness of this process, I was completely unaware of it until one evening when I made a simple request of Roy that he could not fulfill. I was cooking for us as I always did, preparing a Spanish omelet. There was an unopened jar of olives sitting on the top shelf of the cupboard, too distant for me to reach. Roy, at his normal height, could reach the shelf easily, without even rising onto his toes. "Roy," I said, pointing. "Olives." After 30 years of marriage, there was no need to use silly words like please or could you. Roy stood behind me, leaning against the kitchen island, reading an article from a restoration magazine. He had recently retired from his job as a general contractor, a reluctant retirement at best, but he had found himself tiring too easily at work, growing bored as he listened to his clientele and their lofty and often misplaced desires for their homes. I had accepted the news of his retirement eagerly, looking forward to having more time with him, but once it was realized, I grew somewhat irritable, now finding him perennially underfoot. I was reminded of my children when they were young, how they needed constant entertainment and care, how tuning them out for even a moment resulted in a high, ceaseless whine. Roy did not sound his whine audibly, of course. After all, he was a grown man, but I could hear it just the same when I walked by him, doing my daily dusting of the shelves or ferrying the laundry to and from the utility room. He would stare up at me with those petulant, beady eyes, as though begging me to guide him somewhere meaningful. It was, needless to say, an awkward adjustment. With a little time, however, we grew accustomed to our new lifestyle. Roy found ways to entertain himself. Magazines, gardening, tiny improvements on our home that I agreed to only if he stayed out of my way. And I learned to tune him out while completing my daily tasks as a housewife. I also took up the habit of delegating small duties to him, hoping to make him feel as useful and essential to our household as I was. Retrieving the jar of olives was one such thing. Truthfully, I hadn't kept objects on the top shelf for years, but now I did, so that Roy could fetch them for me. It was part of my grand strategy to interrupt his boredom, and it seemed to be working.
Oh,
this is one that my mom has said. I hope this is not about me. It's not, Mom. It's not. Don't worry.
Whatever you need to believe, Mom.
It's fiction. That's the good safeguard I can always hide behind.
In the Field Guide to Monsters of the Inland Northwest, you bring one of the most prevalent monster myths in the West to the forefront. And I'm not talking about that particular story, but there's a story where a scientist, Dr. Rowe, uses that book in a lecture that he's giving. And the Sasquatch and the Bigfoot, especially in the Northwest United States, are this huge ongoing myth. So I suppose you couldn't have a book that had monsters in the title when you're from this area without writing about Sasquatch.
Yeah, I did. That was one of the last stories to go in. And the reason I wrote that story is because I wanted to title the entire collection Field Guide to Monsters of the Inland Northwest. In fact, when I had been circulating that story around to different competitions before it won the Autumn House Prize, that's what it was titled. And it was a finalist at a couple places one year, but the Flannery O'Connor Awards, one of the places it was a finalist for, told me they didn't like that title for the entire book, but they liked it for a short story. And I thought, well, maybe I will write a short story. And what's missing from this, you know, monster collection set in the Northwest? Definitely the Sasquatch.
I really liked the writer's werewolf story. It seemed to me like it might be something that could literally happen. The werewolf was metaphorical, but the idea that somebody who was a mediocre writer would take the brilliance of another really good writer and mark it up with a red pen.
Yeah. I wrote that story after I had a very vivid dream that was that story from start to finish. And I don't remember having the dream, but when I woke up, I wrote it down in my journal. And a couple years later, as I was, you know, I had already written the Cyclops story, I think, and I was flipping back through my journal, and I saw that story there, the dream just written out in really vivid detail. And I thought, I could really write a whole story about this. And I think every writer can speak to some sort of writer envy they have. And I think it's really important to be helpful to other writers and to not, you know, hurt or hinder anyone. But that's precisely what little Nicky, the narrator of that story, does. He ends up really putting his friend down, who happens to be a werewolf, because his friend takes up writing because of Nicky's influence, and it ends up just really rubbing Nicky the wrong way, and he's filled with envy, and that's why he ends up being really dishonest and cruel about it when he actually reads the and gives feedback on the werewolf's work, which is supposed to be phenomenal, that he's just has this natural talent. So I always wonder what that dream was. Like, was I Nicky in that dream when I had it? I mean, obviously I had it for a reason, and I never dream like that. I don't usually write stories based on my dreams. I know a lot of authors do, but that's really the only one I can say that I had like that. But, you know, I wonder, looking back, who's the werewolf? Who's the, you know, my husband is this, he's a writer too. We met in the writing program, and he's this big, handsome, furry guy. I'm like, maybe it's Sam, you know, we've laughed about that, before. Like he's the natural talent, and I'm the, you know, I've just always wanted to do it, and I'm pushing myself to do it or something. And my brother has this great theory that, both sides of the story, Nicky and the werewolf, are both me. Like, one of them is, you know, my werewolf, which is my just, when I'm not concerned about what anybody thinks about me, when I'm writing really naturally and freely. And then Nicky is my editorial self that comes in and is too self-conscious and really critical. And I think that's a pretty brilliant reading of that story too.
Sharma Shields lives with her family in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about her and favorite monster at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Be sure to spell right with a W. Also there, book reviews, poems, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.